Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
How do you tell a love story in three parts, over time, from three perspectives? Julian Barnes will be here to talk about his new novel, The Only Story. What makes Texas so special and so confounding to those who don't live there? Lawrence Wright joins us to talk about his new book, God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State. Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Julian Barnes joins us now. His latest book is called The Only Story. Julian, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
I actually want to start with the book that you wrote right before this, because this is very much a departure, and sort of how you got from that book to this one, and were you eager to get back to fiction?
Well, the last book was a novel, but it was a sort of non-fiction novel, and this is absolutely a fiction novel. I think that my books often vary quite sharply, one from the last. That's how I've always operated. This, if it ties to any other book, perhaps ties to The Sense of an Ending, which was the book two novels ago, in that it's about a relationship between a young man and a middle-aged woman, which was central to the other book, but absolutely not described. In that book, Sense of an Ending, the reader had to intuit what happened. And so possibly it must be related to that I thought I would write about it more overtly this time.
But it's interesting, too, in that with Levels of Life, it was sort of three distinct parts, one kind of memoir and sort of history and fiction,
right?
And this is also a novel told in three parts.
Well, I think three parts is fairly classic. You know, there's something about the triad form which works in literature, music, art. It's also true that I like mixing genres, that to write just a plain, as it were, novel is fairly rare for me. I always think that what's important is the story, and whether it's invented or found is irrelevant if the story is strong enough.
Well, I want to get back to that idea of just a plain novel. I mean, is this just a plain novel?
Well, it is, yes. I mean, it doesn't have any non-fiction elements in. I suppose it has a reflective side. I'm sometimes accused of being an essayistic novelist, and I like the idea of there being ideas in novels. And there are, you know, many ruminations on love in the book.
Was it a love story?
Of course it's a love story.
All right, so the love story is between two characters, Paul and Susan. Tell us a little bit about them.
Paul is 19. He's on his summer vacation after his first year at university. She is 48, married to a rather sinister husband, two daughters, both of whom are older than Paul. They meet, and he can't believe how banal it seems, they meet at a tennis club where they enter a mixed doubles competition, or they are entered by lot into a mixed doubles competition. And they just get on in a way that neither of them has got on with a person of the opposite sex before. They are each other's second lover, even though she is much older than him. You know, she is of that generation. This opens in the 60s. Mm-hmm. So she is of that generation of women whose first introduction to sex would be through marriage, and often not a very good introduction to sex.
Well, that brings us to Gordon, her husband. It seems like you're commenting on a certain generation of English man with that character.
Well, he's emotionally secretive, clever, enclosed, aggressive, both physically and verbally. The only man in a household of women, which I think always does something to the male personality. I think it grows often in strange ways if it's surrounded by women. One of the early points of the novel is that Paul, describing his love story, his only story, says, I don't think that social, historical detail or times actually are important in love stories. Love stories exist by themselves. By the end of the book, he realizes that the times in which he and his lover, Susan, and her husband grew up are absolutely fundamental to how they understand love and how they express themselves. May I read you something?
Absolutely.
This is from a friend sent me this, and it's about North Korea, which is indeed in the news nowadays. And she says, this is a paragraph from a book on North Korea I'm currently reading. Quote, if you grow up in the West, you may think that romance occurs naturally, but it does not. You learn how to be romantic from books and movies or from observation. But there was no model to learn from in my parents' time. They didn't even have the language to talk about their feelings. You just had to guess how your beloved felt from the look in his eyes or the tone of her voice when she spoke to you. Fascinating, isn't it?
And that's Paul's
generation.
You're
just guessing. And you know, it's obviously better for Paul and Susan Gordon then. They have some articulation. But somehow when you fall in love, you somehow think it's something which is completely separate from the world. And you think that the extent to which you talk about it is normal, natural. Whereas, right, in fact, it's all sort of socially bound up. So those poor North Koreans were just guessing from the look in the eye. Well, that can go wrong, can't it? And now, in my lifetime, things have changed a great deal. I mean, when I was growing up, you know, you had a girlfriend, you went out with her for a bit, and then the sex question came up. Sometimes she said no, mm-hmm, and so on. And nowadays I have a New Yorker friend who's an African art expert, and she retrained as a filmmaker about a dozen years ago. And so she was in with lots of kids. And she said, it's fascinating, they didn't mind who they went to bed with, but they were terrified of love. Within two generations, things turn around.
Well, Paul is roughly of your generation.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
But what were you trying to say about the way in which young men in general in England at that time approached relationships?
Well, I think for my generation, there was a great deal of unfocused idealism and an expectation that if you found someone you loved, then it would all naturally work out. Of course, we'd read the great novels, which on the whole teach you that love doesn't work out, mm-hmm, which is indeed what is the case with Paul later on in the book. I think we were kind of emotionally blurting compared to our parents, and sort of not very good at analyzing love. But then who is, or who is first time out? You know, it's a bit like putting in a new kitchen. You never get it right the first time. You always have that bit of slate you shouldn't have, or the taps are in the wrong place. And then you redesign, you have another kitchen, and there are different mistakes are made.
But Paul's point, and the title, right, is that the first time you fall in love is sort of the only story. It's the story that you...
Not necessarily, but he thinks that we all of us have only one story. Even if we think we have many stories, there's only one that counts, and it's always the one about love. And in his case, it was that, you know, there was one big love in his life and then various lesser contingent relationships after it ended.
Is it the only story for Paul or for Susan as well, this story?
It's less clear. He ponders at that towards the end of the book, whether he was her only story or whether Gordon, her husband, might have been. I think he was. Speaking as the author, I happen to know that,
purely speculative
here. He was her only story as well, yes, because it was the one that blew her life up.
So going back to this idea of just a plain novel, I mean, it's not really just a plain novel. You're always sort of doing something formally inventive in
your book. Oh, yes.
I mean,
by plain novel, I didn't have any currents in. I just meant that it was it didn't have any non-fiction elements in.
Was there a challenge that you sort of set out for yourself, or is there with each book? Like,
yes.
Well, this time what I'm going to try to do is this?
Well, you spend a lot of time sort of mooching, I find, in the early months of approaching a novel. And
mooching off of others' work, so your own?
No, mooching. No, I'm just lounging around, just sort of.
Okay, this is a Britishism versus
Britishism. Nosing around, going off in different directions, and a lot of the notes I make at that time often start with "How about?" and with a question mark at the end. You know, because if you write it down as a statement, then it looks as if you've made a decision. But so, often, I mean, I'm sure other writers do this too, or "What if?" that sort of thing you write. One of the key moments in a book, it seems to me, is when the form comes to you, when you know exactly how it's going to be told, what form. Flaubert said, there's no idea without a form and no form without an idea. And it's when those two come together that the ignition happens and the novel can take place. So I was thinking, do I tell this in the first person? Obviously, first love is natural for the first person. It happens in the first person. It happens in the present tense. And then I was thinking, when you're looking back on love, and also in your more senior years, life often turns into a third-person narrative rather than the first-person narrative. And so I thought I'd use the third person for the final section. And then I thought, well, why would I use the second person at some point in the novel? Because it's rare and difficult to use the second person. Mm-hmm.
Certainly to sustain over the course of a full narrative.
Yes, indeed. Indeed, the only book I can think of that really, really works as a second person narrative is Jay McInerney's Bright Lights, Big City.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it starts off something like, you're in a place you shouldn't be at this time of night or something like that. And it absolutely grabs you. When you say you, it's a present tense, but it's also sort of kind of collusive.
Mm-hmm.
You're sort of bringing the reader with you, putting an arm around the waist or the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it would work for the darker central section of the book, because I could imagine readers saying, oh, well, you know, that's nothing to do with me. Or I can't imagine that.
You're bringing them in and making them
complicit. So you bring the reader in with this arm around the shoulder and say, as if it's the reader's experiencing it as directly as the narrator. And I was pleased when I thought of that, because, you know, to have something formal to get your teeth into as well as something in terms of content is always very satisfying.
So you had the form early on then of these shifting narratives.
Yes, that's at the point where I knew I knew how it was going to go as a novel, yes.
How did you deal with the passage of time in the book?
There are various disadvantages of being an older writer, and there are various advantages. And one of the advantages is that you learn how to move characters through time in a way that you didn't when you were younger. When you're younger, you tend to write novels which follow, you know, the characters follow almost a chronological sequence of events. And then at a certain point, you realize actually you can move them through, A, you can move them through time in a different way, and B, you can put a great stop in the narrative and pick it up 40 years later. That's what I did with The Sense of an Ending. It goes up to about the age of 20, and then all of a sudden, the character is 60, and he does the middle of his life in about a page. I think this is generally true. There are some writers who are always utterly brilliant in moving through time. Alice Munro, for example, mm-hmm. great, great writer. And I think maybe it's short story writers are better than novelists because they're having to concentrate
to
so much to actually to move through time in 8 or 10 pages. Updike, whom I revere, as in his later work, became even better at moving through time and making bold jumps. So it's just something that you learn to do, and it's partly an act of boldness, yes.
All right, I'm going to get how many novels have you written now?
This is my 13th.
Okay, so your 13th novel, and you said earlier that you try to sort of, you think of each one as a kind of separate entity.
Yeah, but yes, I do, but I admit that that's self-deceiving and that, in fact, they must be connected in some way. It's just I don't want to know how they're connected.
But do you think that you're revisiting similar themes?
I'm bound to be, yes, and I think, I don't know how many more novels I will write, but obviously in the last two or three, themes of memory and time have become more important, yes.
Were there books about memory or time? I mean, you mentioned the short stories and the sort of the way that other writers technically do it, but that you thought of that you
Well, I don't think I'm writing about memory and time. I think that you want to tell a story just as you did when you were in your 30s. It's just that now you know more about memory and its elusiveness and its unreliability, and you know a bit more about time and age. And therefore, these are new things that you can bring to your writing.
In the third part of the book, you bring it up to the present day.
Yes. Yes, I do. Yes. Yes, there's even a reference to a Formula One Grand Prix, which took place only about 9 months ago.
Well, there's also this other thing that's happened in Britain recently called Brexit. And I'm wondering if you were thinking about that and if that event has kind of infiltrated your work in any way.
Well, funnily enough, I predicted it in a novel called England, England, which I wrote in 1998. And it was predicated on the notion that the idea of nation states has become degraded, and that internationally life has become more and more homogenized, and there are various tokens and symbols that we say, but this proves that we're British or French or American. And a mogul, an international rich mogul, decides to put a theme park on a small island off the south of England and put everything that is British into it. So all the tourists will go there mm-hmm. instead of having to go all the way around England. And this leads to a gradual decline of England. And it ends with the European Union throwing us out because we're so annoying as a country and indeed paying us to go. So I was sort of vaguely proud of that. I mean, we've always been awkward cousins in Europe. Britain is very divided between Europhiles and Europhobes and always has been. And that's not helped by some of the popular press.
But it's funny because, I mean, I remember in those years when that book came out in 98 and I think 1997 or maybe 98, you had like the cover of The Economist with Tony Blair and his tooth sort of gleaming and this whole idea of the New Britannia and a lot of optimism around
yes.
Britain at that time. But I take it you weren't necessarily buying that.
Oh, no, I wasn't buying Tony Blair. I thought Tony Blair was a nice conservative. I interviewed him. I was, if I may mention a rival publication, I was British correspondent for The New Yorker at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And one piece I wrote, I interviewed him just after he became Labour leader. And I thought he was very bright and very personable and would lead the Labour Party to victory, but was not very left-wing at all.
The New Labour.
It was yes, indeed, calling it the New Labour. I'm kind of old Labour. So I didn't think that we were going to, it was just branding. It was branding, you know, this New Britannia, a cool Britannia, wasn't it?
Right.
Things didn't change under him in the way that the previous branding was the sort of the 60s and the Beatles and that sort of thing. That did mark a seismic change in British society and British morals and attitudes to generational difference and so on. Whereas Mrs. Thatcher, when asked what was your greatest achievement, replied, Tony Blair.
Hmm.
A brilliantly, brilliantly destructive comment.
Yeah. So I take it you were not shocked by Brexit then?
It's funny. I was having dinner when I have a big birthday. My foreign publishers, European publishers come and we all get together and we have dinner. And I had to make a little speech. I said, look, you'd better realize that in 2 weeks' time, we may well vote to leave you. And they all thought, ho, ho, that's British humor.
Mm-hmm.
I really did think that was likely to happen. On the other hand, I didn't see Trump coming. So I got
so
one
you
out
got
of
half a half of it,
yes,
right?
Yes.
All right, we'll bring you, but let's go back to the book before we end here. Would you mind reading a passage?
Sure. Which bit?
I will leave that up to you.
Okay, well, I'll read the very start. I'll just read the first three paragraphs, perhaps.
Excellent.
Is that enough?
That's perfect.
Would you rather love the more and suffer the more, or love the less and suffer the less? That is, I think, finally, the only real question. You may point out, correctly, that it isn't a real question, because we don't have the choice. If we had the choice, then there would be a question, but we don't, so there isn't. Who can control how much they love? If you can control it, then it isn't love. I don't know what you call it instead, but it isn't love. Most of us have only one story to tell. I don't mean that only one thing happens to us in our lives. There are countless events which we turn into countless stories. But there's only one that matters, only one finally worth telling. This is mine.
That was Julian Barnes reading from his new novel, The Only Story. Julian, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
This podcast is supported by the Shalom Hartman Institute. For decades, the Shalom Hartman Institute has been the preeminent destination for Jewish ideas and learning. The weekly Identity Crisis podcast with host Yehuda Kurtzer creates better conversations around issues facing contemporary Jewish life. For Heaven's Sake, the award-winning number one Judaism podcast with Daniil Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi features thoughtful discussions on political and social trends in Israel and Israel-diaspora relations. Discover these chart-topping podcasts at shalomhartman.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Lawrence Wright joins us now from Toronto, where he is on book tour for his new book, God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State, reviewed this week on our cover by David Oshinsky. Lawrence, thanks so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
So this is not your first book, obviously, but is it a book that you always wanted to write? Did you always feel like you had to write about your home state?
No. I was not going to ever write about Texas again. I used to work for Texas Monthly, and when I left that magazine, I thought, I don't want to be a regional writer, and I'm just going to leave Texas out of it. I continue to live in Texas, but I thought I better not try to write about it. And that was my opinion for about 30 years.
What made you change your mind?
Well, my editor, David Remnick at The New Yorker, asked me to explain Texas. And, you know, there are a lot of my colleagues that don't really understand why I live there. Because I, you know, my career is not in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
It's in New York or L.A., often in Washington, abroad, but, you know, not in Texas. And some of them are just, frankly, puzzled that I would live there. And I wondered about it myself many times. Why am I living in a place where, it's, you know, my work is not here, but it is my home, and that's pretty much what it made me decide to take a look at it for myself.
So you wrote about it first in The New Yorker, but then why turn it into a whole big book?
Well, when Remnick said that to me, I reminded him I get paid by the word.
Mm-hmm.
And once I get wound up on a story, it's hard to stop. And I found that just so much that I wanted to cover, things that had been very meaningful to me, both pro and con, about the state that I live in. You know, I love the culture, I love the music, you know, and I sometimes worry about the politics and where it's taking us.
Only sometimes.
Well, you know, the legislature only comes to town every other year. People seem amazed that we don't have a constant legislature, but frankly, I wish it were every 5 years because the damage that they can do in the space of a half a year's session is pretty considerable.
So there have been a number of books that have sort of tried to explain Texas to the rest of us Americans, especially those of us on the coasts who don't get it, right? But so how did you approach it?
Well, I'm aware of the stereotypes. You know, I've lived with them my entire life. You cannot be a Texan and not run into the unconscious prejudices that everybody has about the state. So I kept those in mind, and I wanted to address them, but I'm not writing about the stereotypes. I want to write from the inside what it's like to be a Texan, what it stands for, where it's headed, and what it means to America.
Were you born in Texas?
I was born in Oklahoma City, and then we moved to Abilene. My dad was an itinerant banker, so we went to Abilene when I was about 10. And then we stayed there for 3 years, I think, and then we moved to Dallas.
That sounds like an oxymoron, an itinerant banker.
Well, he was in World War II in Korea, and he had been a lawyer, but he decided that wasn't his trade. So he was started out in small banks, Oklahoma, and then in Texas, and then he got a job as president of a little pocket bank, practically. I was in a strip shopping center in Dallas, and he built it up into a major institution. So, you know, that was the attraction for people like my dad. Texas gave people opportunities.
Mm-hmm. You know, the sense that maybe you get is from people who don't live in Texas is, well, it's okay to be from Texas, but, you know, maybe not okay to choose to go back there. And yet you did.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I say I'm from Texas, and people often ask, where are you from? They maybe detect an accent or something. And if I say I'm from Texas, you get a reaction, and it's not always favorable. But if someone follows up and says, where from in Texas? And I say Austin, it's, you know, like, oh, you know, it's forgivable.
Well, then that's okay.
Yeah. And often very sympathetic, you know, of what you must put up with. Austin is probably the most liberal city in the entire southern tier of the United States. But I love the whole of Texas. You know, and people don't understand. They have totally different impressions of the place that I live in. Yes, Austin is liberal, but all the cities in Texas are blue. Even Fort Worth, if you break it free from the entity of Tarrant County, which is what people normally look at as counting Fort Worth red, the city votes blue.
And maybe the little town of Marfa.
Yes, then Marfa, of course. Marfa is a very eccentric little place way out in West Texas, 200 miles from any airport, and yet it's become a destination for art lovers.
Is Austin still a Texan city? Does it feel like Texas and Austin, or does it feel totally apart from the rest of the state?
There's always been a progressive liberal core inside Texas. When I was a kid, Texas was blue and California was red. Texas produced LBJ and the Great Society, probably the greatest liberal accomplishment of 20th century, excepting maybe only Franklin Roosevelt. Reagan came out of California. Within the conservative entity of Texas, there's always been a very progressive heart.
But When you talk about LBJ, I mean, he didn't start off as a progressive when he was in Texas.
No. Oh, he was very adept at manipulating the prejudices and making people think he was one thing, and his actions showed he was something else. Although I will also say I think he changed. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, what was motivating LBJ was the need to help bring his people out of poverty. And I think one of the signal events in his life was when he was a school teacher down in Cotulla, Texas, you know, teaching Mexican-American kids and showing them how to excel. It was a transformative moment, and I think he never left that behind.
One of the things that, you know, distinguished and I think it's remarkable to many outsiders about Robert Caro's approach to LBJ is that he felt that he couldn't write about him unless he actually moved to the hill country of Texas where LBJ grew up in order to understand him. Do you think that you have to live in Texas to really get it?
Oh, I think you do. And I say that as a reporter who often goes into places I don't understand and presumes to write about them. It makes such a difference when you actually experience the ordinary life I had this experience when I was writing about terrorism, and I lived in Saudi Arabia for a while. And I had a job mentoring young reporters at this newspaper in Jeddah, Bin Laden's hometown. And I only did that because they wouldn't let me in as a reporter. But I found, you know, once I was living there, that my understanding just geometrically increased. And I think that's true for any, we don't always have the luxury to do that.
Right.
But it sure makes a difference.
So explain to us this then, for those of us who don't live in Texas and have never lived there. I mean, how did it get to be so red? How did it go from being blue, as you said it was in your childhood, to being probably one of the most super Trump right-wing conservative Republican states there is?
Well, I had a conversation with Karl Rove, who is an Austin resident. He's probably the most despised Austin resident, and he loves that. But I asked him about how that happened, and he said it was immigration. You know, that Texas, of course, has been bringing in people for decades. You know, it's just growing and growing and growing. And in the 50s and 60s, a lot of people who were moving to Texas were Republicans, like my dad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a veteran, and he was an Eisenhower Republican, and he brought his Republicanism with him. Then a lot of people like my dad moved to Dallas, and it was the first city to elect a Republican congressman. You know, that was the beginning of the transformation. And people moved to, you know, when they moved to Texas in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, they tended to move into the suburbs. And the suburbs were largely Anglo. They were a lot more like each other than they were like the cities they surrounded. They were new. They were white. They had evangelical churches, oftentimes of enormous size. And that's where the strength of the Republican Party has been and continues. But interestingly, immigration now is changing the state in the other direction, and the suburbs as well. So they're not quite as red as people would think nowadays. It's really changing.
But it seems to have changed, too. I mean, when you think back to the 90s, and you had Ann Richards, who was a liberal Democrat, and at least it, you know, it seems from the outside in most respects.
Oh, fair enough to say, yeah.
How did it get from Texas being able to elect a governor statewide office like that to, you know, a situation now where it would be impossible to elect a Democrat like Ann Richards at the state level in Texas?
Well, I think that one of the big things that happened in the 2000s was the redistricting, which was actually pioneered in Texas. When Republicans gained control of the state legislature, the mm-hmm. state House of Representatives, that's where redistricting is done. And Tom DeLay, who, if you remember him,
oh, yes.
The majority whip, and he and Tom Craddock, who was elected Speaker of the Texas House, they began to carve up Texas districts. And like my district, I mean, I live in Austin. It was a historic congressional district that Lyndon Johnson once represented, and it was carved into six different districts,
mm-hmm.
five Republicans and one Democrat. You know, my representative is a car dealer in Weatherford, 200 miles north. So it was a punitive action, but it was created to make invulnerable districts that are almost impossible to change.
So is that gerrymandering? Has it ever been under challenge in Texas?
Oh, yeah. The Supreme Court just heard an appeal of it just last week. We will see. It could make a big difference. Nationally, it would make a modest difference, but a real difference in Texas to have, let me say it this way. Texas is much more progressive than its elected representatives would lead you to believe.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem in Texas in terms of its politics or in terms of moving in that direction is that Texans just don't vote. We're always the bottom or right next to it. And it's a puzzle in some respects because, you know, we're a state of 29 million people. 19 million Texans are registered to vote, but only about half of them actually voted. So, you know, here you have people who took the trouble to register but not to vote. And whatever it is that need, you know, is required to motivate them to get to the polls, and I think is the absence of appealing candidates, especially Hispanic ones.
Right.
That has kept that from happening.
Well, how much of it, too, is, I mean, one of the points that you make in the book is that there's a lot of money in Texas. There are, you know, great museums, redevelopment of some of the cities, you know, architecture. And yet the funding for things like education is very low. You would wonder if it also, if that's not a factor.
This is a scandal, in my opinion. Texas spends, I think it's 49th out of 50th in terms of its per student contribution. And, you know, what happens is property taxes go up in order to make up the difference. And, you know, of course, people are feeling the burden. And in the last legislative session, they were trying to put a brake on the rise of property taxes without supplying any actual new money to the schools from other sources. And there was even a movement to try to take some of that public education money and put it into private schools. Well, what's going on here? The, you know, 10% of all the school children in America are Texans. So, it's, you know, what we do in Texas with our kids has national implications.
And also because Texas is the state that kind of dictates the textbooks across the country.
Yeah. That's absolutely true, and exercises a lot of influence over what school children all over America actually read. It's maddening to me, and I don't understand why the legislators don't stand up to the plate and educate our children. There's one explanation that comes to mind, which is that public education involves largely black and brown kids.
Right.
And if that is the reason, then shame, shame, shame. It's just, you know, we cannot. This is the future of Texas and the future of America, and we have to educate our children. That's the most important thing that Texas legislators can do. And secondly, it would be building the infrastructure for the future, because Texas is expected to double in population by the year 2050. At which time it will be about the size of New York and California combined.
And what percentage of that population is currently Hispanic?
Almost 40%, almost exactly what it is in California. So, we're both majority-minority states.
Which is just stunning when you think about the political representation. And I want to talk about some of those political figures that you describe in the book. And let's start with Dan Patrick, just to give people a sense of the political leadership. So he's currently the lieutenant governor of Texas. Who is Dan Patrick?
Dan Patrick is a shock jock radio guy from Houston. Like a lot of Texans, he went through bankruptcy in the 80s and then managed to buy a radio station for the debt and had the perspicacity to sign Rush Limbaugh, at that time an unheard of radio personality, for the only station in Houston that would broadcast him. Dan Patrick is also a very, very popular radio personality himself. And when he ran for office, he defeated a field of, I think, about 11 people outright and went to Texas Senate and then got elected the very next session. He ran for lieutenant governor. He's probably the most conservative person we've ever elected to office in Texas. And by conservative, I don't mean that he's a business conservative. He's a social conservative of the extreme Tea Party type. And, you know, his agenda this previous session had to do with sanctuary cities and the bathroom bill, which he failed to get enacted.
Give us some examples of things that Dan Patrick has said and done, because there are pretty striking.
The thing that alarms me the most about him is his association with the homophobic right wing, exhibited most tellingly by Dr. Stephen Hotze, a business partner of his, who also has a radio show on Dan Patrick's station. And this is a guy who is probably the most homophobic public figure that we have in the state who is saying that the agenda of the public education is to promote sodomy in kindergarten. It's absurd. And yet, you know, a lot of the money and the support for Dan Patrick comes from Stephen Hosey and his followers. When you look at where the money comes from and where the, you know, the public support comes from, that's the thing that I think sends off the most alarm bells.
One of the things that people were saying on the Democratic side after the election of Donald Trump was that, well, you know, what we really need to do is mobilize on the state level and, you know, get people elected in state legislatures and also obviously elected to Congress. Is that happening in Texas? Is there energy there?
No, there's a lot of energy. The real question is sometimes, like in the presidential election, there was a tremendous amount of energy among Democrats. I was going to say among Democratic voters, but it was, you know, they didn't actually manifest themselves at the poll. The pollsters were examining Texas, and there was one poll that had Hillary winning the state by 1 point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she, you know, Trump took the state by 9 points. That was actually quite a bit lower. I think Romney took the state by 17 points or something close to that. And 9 points, it was the same margin of victory that Trump had in Ohio, which you would not think of as a Republican stronghold. So, you know, there was a lot of energy, but, you know, when it came to voting, Texans just didn't turn out. Once again, we were very close to the bottom in terms of voter turnout.
Obviously, you have the gerrymandering issue. Is it widespread? Do people think in Texas that their vote won't count because of that? Or is it more a function of poverty and education? And is there voter suppression?
I think the voter suppression thing is overblown in Texas. You know, there are voter ID laws, but in Texas, we vote. You can vote for 2 weeks at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Not like New York, you know, where you have to one day go to the polls. And, you know, you got, you know, weeks you can mail in your ballot. It's easy to vote in Texas if you are registered. So, you know, the question is, who is it that is not voting? And, you know, Hispanics vote in California, but they don't in Texas. So why is that? Some people say that they're, you know, that it's the absence of unions in Texas, and the grape workers in California organized Hispanic votes and turned that population political. I think that there's a different way of looking at it, which is, you know, when you examine who doesn't vote all across the country, it's the young, the poor, and the poorly educated. And we have a lot of Hispanics in Texas that fall into that category. But I think the main thing is the absence of inspiring candidates who would appeal to that constituency. We have some, the Castro brothers, for instance, but they've never offered themselves for a statewide office. Right now, we have a really interesting race between Beto O'Rourke from El Paso running against Ted Cruz.
Right.
And Beto is not Hispanic, despite his nickname, but he does speak Spanish. And Cruz, who is Cuban by way of Canada, doesn't speak Spanish. So it'll be a telling moment in this coming election to see how Hispanic voters do, because when people ask me if Texas can turn purple or blue, I say it will inevitably, but, you know, it could do so very suddenly.
The subtitle of your book is A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State, and there's a highway on the cover of the book. Did you travel to parts of Texas that you'd never been to in the course of researching the book?
Yeah, but bear in mind, I've lived most of my life in Texas, so there's not a whole lot of places I haven't been to, but it's a huge
state. It's a big state, yeah.
It is a very big state. And, you know, I had never really delved into the oil business. And so I spent a lot of time in Odessa and Midland in the Permian Basin getting an education in that subject. And that was fascinating to me because, you know, we wouldn't be talking about Texas now if it weren't for oil. It was oil that made Texas what it is. So it was good for me to get educated finally on this subject.
And Midland, of course, is George W. Bush country. Did you talk to the younger Bush for the book?
No, I known the Bush family. Our daughter went to high school with George W. and Laura's twins, and I'd worked with Laura on the book festival, and I'd met the elder Bushes previously. Nearly every Texan who's delved into politics can tell you something about the Bush family. I was sad to hear about Barbara Bush's passing because my experience with them is that they always had a kind of civility that seems so remote in our politics today.
Well, speaking of our politics today, is this book one that you conceived of before the election? And if so, how did the election results of 2016 maybe shape the book?
I think when David Remnick asked me to write about Texas, he imagined that Texas would play a larger role in the presidential election. You know, after all, there were, you know, Ted Cruz, Jeb Bush, who, you know, grew up in Texas, Rand Paul, you know, a lot of Texas figures, and they turned out not to be.
Instead, it's so like the Queen's Long Island presidency.
Yeah, you know, and I always think that Trump embodies so many of the stereotypes that people associate with Texas. You know, the kind of braggadocio, the careless personal life, the roller coaster financial career, and, you know, those are all Texas qualities. And I've wondered if New York would ever be taken down for Trump the way that that Fort Worth would have been.
Mm-hmm. So how did the results of the election, did that alter the way you approached the book?
No. Once I got launched on this, what I was more interested in was, you know, how the state functioned.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was interesting that, you know, Trump did carry the state, but not as, you know, conclusively as one would have expected. But it does show to me what was interesting. I think, you know, you can see the fault lines of the state more clearly when you're engaged in an election. And it's clear that Texas is changing, and it's constantly changing. It's always moving in one direction or another, just as California is. You know, I think of us as being kind of like strands of DNA that revolve around each other and are in a relation but never actually touch each other. Texas will be turning blue. This seems, you know, so evident to me. But when, that's the big question about Texas.
So you said that you had already been to these areas of Texas, but as you also acknowledge, Texas is changing. What in the course of reporting this book did you learn about Texas that surprised you or that you hadn't known or that was different from how it used to be?
I guess when you ask that question, what immediately comes to mind is Houston. I grew up in Dallas, and we kind of looked down our noses at Houston as being this kind of blue-collar oil town, a great place for barbecue and two-stepping, which is still true. But Houston is considered the most diverse city in America. It has not a single ethnic group that is a majority. And, you know, 20%, I believe, of Houstonians were born in another country.
Wow.
It has more political refugees than any other city. By some metrics, it has the highest standard of living of any city in America. This is not the Houston that I envisioned when I started spending a lot of time there. And I've grown to become really affectionate towards that city. You know, I was there during the hurricane because we have a play that's actually going on right now. But it was supposed to open in October, but the theater was drowned. And I was so impressed by the fact that the Alley Theater was able to tear up their schedule and find a place for us in the spring. And, you know, just testament to the spirit the city and the state have.
You mentioned earlier that you don't like to think of yourself as a regional writer, or you didn't want to when you were working at Texas Monthly, writing for Texas Monthly magazine. Do you think of yourself as a Texan writer, or do you think of yourself as a Texan?
Oh, I do, yeah. It's a big part of my identity. But whether I wanted to live the rest of my life in Texas was the question. You know, I can't get away from the cultural heritage that every Texan carries with him. And some of it is just part of the myth that we all live with, the cowboy, the oil man, you know, all of these things that all over the world, people have an impression of Texas. I remember when I was teaching as a young man at the American University in Cairo, I used to go riding out at the stables that were near the pyramids. And you know, I'm a city boy. I'm no cowboy, but they found out that I was from Texas. They actually started calling me Texas. And one day they said, "Oh, Texas, we've got a horse for you." And two guys lead this rearing stallion out, his nostrils flaring, and it was terrifying. But you know, being from Texas, I had to get on the horse, and he took me halfway to Libya before I was able to turn him around.
Yeah.
And I really felt that I was astride the Texas myth. Every Texan in some way feels the distance between the image that people have of the state and the reality of who they are. But it's also kind of cool to have that, you know, to have that legacy that you involuntarily have on your shoulders.
Yeah, I think that probably most of the people I grew up around wouldn't get on that horse.
Well, they'd be wise not to, let me tell you.
All right, Larry, thank you so much. Such a pleasure to talk to you. You always take these incredibly interesting subjects and then make them even more fascinating in your book. So I appreciate
it. Thank you, Pamela. I enjoyed chatting with you.
The book again is God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State by Lawrence Wright, and it's reviewed this week on the cover of the Book Review. Alexandra Alter joins us now with some news from the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So this was a really newsy week.
It really was. First of all, we had the first sales figures come in for James Comey's book, A Higher Loyalty, and they were massive, 600,000 copies. Of course, that includes pre-orders, and there's been anticipation for months on this book. But, compared to some other bestsellers like Hillary Clinton's memoir, which came out last fall, titled What Happened, and also even Michael Wolff's first week of sales, he really kind of blew those away. Those each sold around 300,000 copies in their first full week on sale.
All right.
So after that—
And then murder.
Then murder. So
and
there
rape.
Was
it's
another
story.
Interesting story that brought back into the news a book that I had written about earlier this year. The book is titled All Begun in the Dark by Michelle McNamara, and it's a true crime story about the Golden State Killer. Michelle McNamara tragically died before she could finish the book or identify the killer, and this is a cold case that went back to the 80s, a serial killer who had terrorized communities in California for decades, and no one had ever been able to identify him. So the police actually identified the suspect this week. They have a man in custody. His name is Joseph James D'Angelo, who is 72, and he's a former police officer. It was interesting because, the book, I think, while it wasn't directly related to the arrest, at least that's what the authorities said at the press conference, they hadn't taken a name or a suspect or a bit of information from the book and used it to track him down. I think it did have an undeniable impact on public interest in the case and probably resources that went into the case, and her work sort of kept the killer in sort of the public imagination.
But do we know what it is that triggered this arrest?
They were a little bit vague in the press conference. They said that it was based on DNA evidence and that they had matched him up with those earlier crimes, but it wasn't clear what had led him to this particular person. Once you sort of started to piece things together, of course, it's always easy in hindsight to sort of make a case for, why somebody should have been on your radar. There were things like he was a former cop who was let go from his job because he was caught shoplifting. And the items that he stole were dog repellent and a hammer. And this was a criminal who would break into people's homes at night. He would rape women and moved on from rape to murder and murdered women and men. So the dog repellent was probably a red flag.
But those were purchases made long ago.
They were. I'm saying when you sort of look at this man's profile,
right,
it somewhat makes sense. But he was so careful and so under the radar. So anyway, the book I thought was fascinating when I wrote about it in February, in part because it was only half written when she died. And Michelle McNamara's husband, the comedian Patton Oswalt, hired two researchers to finish it. And instead of sort of making this sort of seamless true crime story, they really left the sort of pieces of the book in place so that you could see sort of the jagged edges of it. You had the chapters that she had completed. You had parts that she hadn't finished that they tried to flesh out, but they identified themselves as the authors of those parts. You have excerpts from a magazine. You have raw transcripts of interviews she did with investigators. And the other thing that I thought was fascinating about the book is it's not only about this, you know, it was sort of an attempted portrait of a killer who she never could put into focus, but it was also a really sort of heartbreaking account of her obsession with the case and the psychological toll it took on her. And she was so distraught over not being able to identify this killer and kind of tortured by immersing herself in the details of all these murders that she started taking Xanax and things to help her sleep and things to help her focus. And it looks like a mix of those things in her system are what caused her to die at age 46, along with a heart condition.
Undiagnosed heart condition.
Yes, exactly.
So now, given you've read this book and you've read the news stories and saw the news conference about this arrested suspect who seems like there's very strong evidence to indicate that this is probably the guy, do you think that Michelle McNamara was close? Were there things that she got that are now confirmed in your mind by the arrest?
Well, that's interesting. His name doesn't appear in the book. She was still pretty thick in her research, and they had these big, big databases that she and a researcher she was working with had compiled. And they were using, they had two main systems, things that they thought would work to catch the killer. One was sort of geographically locating people who would be of the right age, and she thought this person might have been a runner because he had muscular legs. It turns out he was a scuba diver, a swimmer, so that explains the legs. And they had theories that he worked in construction or real estate because he often targeted neighborhoods where there was that kind of work happening or seemed to have cased areas sort of undercover beforehand. He was always very familiar with the layout of homes and things like that, as if he had like been in the homes before almost. I think what she did, she really was quite convinced toward the end, I think, that DNA would be the key to this, and that turned out to be correct. She thought that if they could match up genealogically to find some relatives of his, if they went into like a database like 23andMe or something like that, because the police did have the killer's DNA, they might be able to find a distant relative who could lead them to him. And I'm not sure if that's what happened. It's possible. The police haven't really elaborated yet on what it was that led them to him, but it's certainly interesting. I think we'll be learning more about it. It'll also be interesting to see kind of what this means for this book. Of course, I'm sure they'll do, they told me that they're going to do an additional chapter for the paperback, kind of, you know, summarizing what the new findings are.
It's been on our bestseller list.
It's been on the bestseller list since it came out in February, and it's sold 150,000 copies. And they're also making an HBO documentary series. And one thing that was interesting, Patton Oswalt told me that they were doing a book event on Tuesday night. Tuesday was the day that the suspect was arrested, but it wasn't made public until Wednesday. So Tuesday night at this book event, the documentary film crew is there. They're in Chicago with members of Michelle McNamara's family in the audience. And Patton Oswalt said to the audience, "I think his time is running out." And meanwhile, he had been arrested a few hours earlier.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you find yourself turning back to the book? Like, do you want to sort of reread sections of it?
There are parts that I'm curious about, and I think I will go back and look over some of the chapters. I think it'll be useful to people sort of trying to understand this person, what his motivations were, and how he managed to evade authorities for so many decades.
Well, tragic that Michelle McNamara didn't live to get to see this moment, but perhaps a vindication of her tenaciousness.
Absolutely,
and
it is.
All right. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us now to talk about what we're reading, we've got my colleagues Lauren Christensen, Tina Jordan, and John Williams. Hi, guys.
Hey, Pamela.
Hi.
All right, let's talk about what we're reading. John, you've got something very slender, as they say, in front of you.
I read this morning, by which I mean I started it this morning and I finished it this morning.
Yeah, that doesn't count. It's like a pamphlet. What is that?
What is it?
It's a pamphlet. It's a 60-page, essentially long, short story by a Japanese writer named Yoko Tawada called The Bridegroom Was a Dog. Our listeners might remember that last week, Parle Sagel, one of our critics, talked about reviewing Tawada's newest novel, which is called The Emissary, which I think she was slightly disappointed in, but she's a big fan of hers in general. And I think in the review called this her masterpiece. It's obviously a very tiny masterpiece, if it is. It's a surreal story. Tawada is a Japanese writer who moved to Germany in her early 20s and has lived there since. She's now approaching 60, I think. And this is the story of a school teacher in Japan who tells her kids a story, a kind of scatological story, fairy tale, about a woman who marries a dog that she knew when she was a child. And then a man mysteriously shows up to her house, doesn't really say who he is, and acts somewhat dog-like, but he's a normal guy in a suit. And they have this sort of affair, and that's pretty much what happens.
It's sort of Gogol-esque sounding.
A little bit. And Parle and Rivka Galchen, who's written a lot about Tawada for us and The New Yorker, both compare her to Kafka. There's a kind of, it's surreal, but it's also understated. Like, it doesn't tell you what to think about it. You just have to accept this odd reality. I enjoyed it. I think it was originally published with two other stories of about the same length in a book. And I think it would help to have other stories with it to kind of give it a little bit more rhythm and context as you get into it. It's kind of odd to read something so short and so jarring. But I did like it, and I'm definitely interested in reading more of her stuff, especially a novel she wrote about a family of polar bears that are a literary family.
They always animal related?
She does a lot with animals. Yes. I don't think always. The new book, I think, is more about a post-apocalyptic Japan where, you know, children are very weak and the elderly are kind of strong and take care of them. So I don't think there are animals in that.
The good thing about all of the subway delays is that you can now read an entire book, albeit a short one, on the train.
Yeah, I don't have that long a commute, but I got pretty much through it.
All right, Tina, you do have a longer commute. What were you reading on the train?
I'm reading two different books, actually. The first one I don't have with me. It's an older novel called Cost by Roxana Robinson. And I picked it up because I've been noticing this trend. You know, I love trends, of mothers who are writing novels about their children who have addiction problems. Now, I don't think Roxana Robinson had a child with an addiction problem. I think this is purely a novel. But I'm seeing a lot of this. And I mentioned it to somebody and they said, oh, well, then if this is a subject that interests you, you have to go read Cost, because it really was the first one like this. Mm-hmm. And it's fabulous. And it's narrated by an Upper East Side mother, you know, who's reluctantly with her ex-husband, like gathering the family for an intervention with one of her sons, and she can't quite wrap her head around the fact that he has a problem. And he's only just shown up in the narrative, but I have to admit that I'm sort of hooked. I can't see this going anywhere good, but she's a lovely writer. And then I'm reading something much lighter, which is Jillian Medoff's novel, This Could Hurt, which came out this last January, which is a comic novel, at least so far, that's sort of a takedown of corporate HR departments. And the main character is the head of HR. And believe me, like, I am learning so much.
That is the best HR subject for satire.
It is. And I'm saying to myself, really? Companies generate reports like every month showing how much, you know, they spent in, you know, medical on each person there. And I'm like, I know all these details that I had no idea. And, you know, she really worked in HR, Jillian Medoff, so I'm guessing she didn't make this stuff up.
Is the head of HR a villain?
No, she's not.
But darn.
But there are definitely villains in the book. And, you know, there's sexual harassment. And I feel like, boy, when she was writing this book, she could not have known that it would be published at this opportune moment, you know, when it was what everybody was talking about.
But you have a third book with you, which you're a speed reader, aren't you?
I am a speed reader.
We should talk
reader
about that at some point.
Are you a speed book reader, John?
I think compared to the average person, I read quickly, but no, I think Tina actually is literally, I think she could probably read two novels
in a day. I want to watch you in action, Tina. I need to see how it's done.
It's a weird thing. I can do it, and then I have excellent recall for like the first week or two. And after that, boom, unless I loved it, unless it was so remarkable that it stuck with me in some way.
Oh, that's the same with me, even reading at a regular clip. I mean, after a couple, right, unless it was really
that's
memorable.
With me. That's just memory.
A slow reader. Yeah. Right, right. All right, it's still unfair, Tina. Lauren, what are you reading?
So the exact opposite of what John's reading, the book I'm about to talk about is neither slim nor surreal. I picked up Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections recently. I've always been kind of ashamed that I'd never really read any Franzen. And I guess I was always intimidated by probably just the sheer volume of the books and some perception that it was going to scare me away and I was never going to get into it. I've probably read the first 30 pages of this book as many times in my life. Like, I've started it and then just dropped it for whatever reason. And then I was summoned to jury duty. And the thing about federal court is that you're not allowed to even bring electronics. So it felt like this really forced, you know, moment of concentration with no distractions. And I said, perfect time for Franzen. So I picked it up. And to my surprise, it actually moved very easily and quickly to me, despite not really being able to relate to this, you know, Midwestern family in the 90s. It wasn't something that necessarily spoke to my experience, but I found the characters so realistic and realistically sort of amoral, not immoral, but just, you know, morality didn't factor into any of their life decisions and their interactions between the three adult children and the aging parents. And it needed to be pared down. I would say it's definitely protracted rather than brief and punchy. But, you know, still, I didn't ever feel bogged down by that or intimidated by his prose. So if anyone has suggestions for the next Franzen book for me to read, because I hope this isn't an anomaly in his... And his
well, yeah, we'll talk afterwards. Yeah.
Okay,
Tina and I both grimace.
There are many Franzen
we'll
opinions right. here right. at the New York Times Book Review.
Right. As, yes,
and your other book is then, completely about morality.
Exactly. That was the perfect contrast. The next book I picked up was Jim Comey's A Higher Loyalty, which is, you know, exactly the opposite. This is not a regular person. This is not someone who just, you know, makes decisions on the fly to try to cover things up. He is almost nerdily moral. You know, he's built his life and career on the foundations of ethical purism, and that really comes through in his prose. And I didn't really have an opinion of him beyond, you know, what the headlines recently and Hillary's book. So I came to this pretty, you know, open-minded, and my impression was that this is a guy who's really holding on to a legacy of what politics and sort of the DOJ and the process of sort of criminal justice once was, and in an era in which it is no longer, which is this new presidency. And it's a really nostalgic, I think, and it obviously very informative, but I didn't expect to find such empathy in this book.
He definitely comes across as sort of an older yeah. America. And what's funny about it, too, is that so much about the Trump presidency and his support has been about sort of trying to get back to an earlier era mm-hmm. in which maybe for many Americans the default was sort of them, meaning like the kind of middle class white male American. And with Comey, he's from that same... You know, he's from that same kind of background, but takes it in a very different direction. I loved when he, early on in the book, says to a colleague, like, he uses the word beep, and the colleague says, yeah. you know, then he sort of preemptively turns to his colleague and says, bet you didn't expect the director of the FBI to use that kind of term. And of course, the irony is that I'm sure that other person wasn't terribly shocked that anyone right. in government would use that word. Maybe. He was shocked that James Comey would use that word, knowing who Comey is, who's kind of this Sunday school teacher, you know, foster father type.
But also this kind of almost this cliche of this literally towering white male figure. I mean, he's 6'8" or something like that. And this kind of bastion of an old guard, which is interesting to me because in my opinion, he only really came to the forefront of our national consciousness very recently. Mm-hmm. So for him to kind of exist as this, you know, institutional legacy was interesting.
Although one of the other things I found interesting about the book is that even though he's only recently become known to most Americans, he's had quite an interesting career, which he writes about and has been involved in three administrations.
Tina, you've
read it too, right?
I read it too.
Yes, I think we all read it. Yeah. So.
I wrote about it for Inside the List, and I asked him a question about process, and he told me that when the book was done, he divided up the manuscript between his five kids and his two sons-in-law, and he paid $20 for every mistake they could find.
That's also like him being a throwback, right? like paying the kids to mow the lawn.
Paying the grown children $20 for each mistake.
For your
and
chores.
He said,
it's also such an old-fashioned fee.
Right.
You know?
Right. He said, and if they saw something more serious, like he called them in one by one to his office to debate the changes they wanted.
It's nerdy.
He's nerdy.
Really nerdy.
Right.
Yeah.
Lovably so. But
John, what did you think of the book?
I really enjoyed it. I think that it's interesting to hear people's, even after they read it, everybody kind of focuses on their opinion about the Hillary episode because that's really what everyone has cared about recently. But it does, that takes up a surprisingly kind of small part of the book in a way. I mean, he ends with a very, you know, rousing, kind of quietly rousing and extended part about Trump. And he definitely gets into his decision about Clinton and her emails. But the first half of the book, like Pamela hinted at, is really about his time prosecuting the mob with Rudy Giuliani in New York and his time growing up. And I don't know, I felt like I got to know him really well. And it also sounded very legitimately like his voice. It doesn't seem like there was a co-writer involved in the project. Sometimes there is, who's kind of silent and not cited. But it really seemed like this was something he very much did himself. And it didn't feel polemical. And I just,
however
I really enjoyed
reading
it.
However you feel about him, the guy can write.
He can write. We know from the memos he can write.
Yeah, it was a very propulsive read. I mean, I kind of could have.
Although I do think that he was trying to build a case to show that what he did both in the with the Clinton emails and in his interactions with Donald Trump were consistent with the kind of moral framework that he had set out for himself. So it sort of it reads, even though it's very narrative and propulsive, as you say, it kind of reads as a kind as a sort of building his case.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, Michiko Kakutani in her review of it for the Times really was very shrewd in pointing out that she thinks it comes from his time as a prosecutor. There is a sense that the book is this argument, but instead of hitting you over the head, he kind of draws you in like you would a jury, and he kind of sets you up to be sympathetic to him and give you the background, and then he kind of slowly puts all the pieces together so that by the end, you do kind of – it's interesting to go back and read political commentary after you read it because you can sort of be drawn into the other side. But while you're in his company, you really believe him, and you're willing to be on his side, and then it kind of takes afterwards to hear the other side get back to the podium and say, but wait, there's this and there's that.
He also has this almost uncanny ability to probably also from his days as a prosecutor to anticipate – criticism or, you know, reactions to what he's saying, whether
right,
it's from the reader or or just the general media. And it really is spot. I find myself often reading something that I thought, you know, a page or two earlier, and he anticipates my reaction and then addresses it, which is a little annoying sometimes, but also just so effective. I feel like I'm in a conversation.
I think it's really interesting that it's selling as much as it is, because for a book like this, I actually think it is provocative and that people will take something from it. It's not just the typical sort of blockbuster that everyone wants to have on their coffee table, but I think this could actually cause interesting conversations to happen. So, Helma, what are you reading? I know you read the Comey a while back.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I think one thing that a number of books I've read recently has in common is exactly that these are books that have been written a lot about, and yet people are buying them and reading them, not just sort of sticking them on their shelves like A Brief History of Time. And that was true of the Fire and Fury, Michael Wolff's book. That was certainly true of Comey's book. And it's also true of the other book that I recently started reading, which is Tara Westover's memoir, Educated, also has been on our bestseller list and debuted at number one. And this is her memoir. She was also earlier on the podcast about growing up in rural Idaho, the daughter of a father who was undiagnosed, but clearly bipolar, maybe even paranoid schizophrenic, and a mother who, in a really harrowing episode early in the book, suffers a traumatic brain injury and works as a midwife and an herbalist. Tara does not go to school. Her family does not get any medical attention and doesn't go to hospitals.
What I found interesting when you spoke to her or somewhere else, I saw her say that she essentially wasn't really homeschooled either.
There
was just no schooling going on.
She would joke about, you know, that to do school would be for her to take a math book down to the basement. And she felt that if her finger touched 50 pages, which she essentially just flipped, that she had done 50 pages of math. And of course, many people know she went on to get a PhD from Oxford. But what I knew the story, I'd heard her talk about it, obviously I'd interviewed her, but I do think it's one of those books you actually have to read to really appreciate. First of all, she's an excellent writer and really good storyteller. And I think she does something with memoir that's been done before, but like David Carr did it in his memoir. But I think she does especially well, which is to kind of interrogate like her own reporting of what her memory, you know, tells her about what happened. So she will go back and ask her siblings for their accounts. And so she approaches it in this kind of really interesting, meticulous way. But what strikes me right now as a reader, and Tina, I know you read this book too, are just the terrifying medical mishaps that this family, I mean, they work in a junkyard, and they're just two really horrific car crashes that the family gets into. And the description of what happens with the mother, I thought especially, is just, you know, they are in a car driving from Arizona back to Idaho. The father impulsively decides that they should leave at night and drive overnight. And so one of the kids is driving, one of her brothers, and he crashes and none of them are wearing seatbelts because, of course, that would imply adopting federal guidelines. And later on, they don't even have seats in the car. But at this point, they have seats, no seatbelts. So there are these injuries, but especially the mother who's in front of the car. And Tara describes the sort of she is slumped over when the car crashes in just this really disturbing posture. And then when she kind of comes to, her face sort of immediately swells with these two apple-sized orbs around her eyes. And her mother sort of asks for dark and quiet and goes down to the basement where she essentially stays for a month. And Tara describes going down there and thinking like that the swelling and distortion couldn't possibly get any worse. And then 24 hours later, it's still worse and worse and worse. And that her mother eventually, her face settles into, for a long period, what is referred to as raccoon eyes, which they called her raccoon eyes because that's what it looked like. But it's actually a medical term where your eyes really are blackened. You can look it up online. I don't recommend it unless you want something to really stick with you. But it's a sign of serious brain trauma. The mother is never the same.
I might have to steal your copy now.
Yeah, you're going to have to steal it.
It's a miracle any of the children lived, frankly, yeah, with the accidents they got into.
Yeah, with no yeah. medical
and help. Also, you know, it's really the father primarily, or the mother certainly is complicit in a lot of this. But there's another incident. I won't go into details on this. You'll have to read it yourself, in which a brother injures his leg and the father really quite deliberately does not treat him. And so, yeah. Educated, a memoir by Tara Westover. That's all for now.
Thanks, Patty.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Inside the New York Times Book Review is produced by Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.